Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
1 year on from the Hamas attack on Israel, Global News podcast listeners have been sending in their questions for BBC correspondents about everything that's happened since, about the escalating conflict in the wider Middle East, and where we might go from here to try to bring an end to the bloodshed. Find the Global News podcast special edition on the Middle East in the regular Global News podcast feed, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from our studios in central London. I'm Julian Marshall. The assassination on September the 27th of the Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah in Beirut has taken the conflict between Israel and the Iranian-backed militant group to a dangerous new level. This past week has seen Israel launch a ground invasion into southern Lebanon and begin a wave of airstrikes in the south and on targets in the capital, Beirut, while Iran launched a large-scale ballistic missile attack on Israel in revenge for the killing of Nasrallah in a heightening cycle of retaliation. In the course of the programme, with developments moving at a bewildering speed, we'll be looking at how the conflict in Lebanon is deepening and its growing humanitarian consequences, finding out how Israel seems to be opening up a new front in the occupied West Bank, and as Iran braces for an Israeli military response, exploring two competing visions for the region from Israel and the Arab world. Well, Israel seems to have an ever-expanding list of what it says are Hezbollah-linked targets as it continues its ground and air offensive in southern Lebanon and aerial assault on Beirut. President Biden, speaking to the media at the White House just a short time ago, said Israel had the right to defend itself but needed to avoid civilian casualties.
The Israelis have every right to respond to the vicious attacks on them, not just from the Iranians, but from everyone from Hezbollah to Houthis to anyway. But the fact is that they have to be very much more careful about dealing with civilian casualties.
Earlier in the week, most targets were in the Hezbollah district of Dahiyeh in the south of Beirut. Increasingly, strikes have hit buildings in the center of the city. One of the overnight targets in the capital is believed to be the man expected to take over as Hezbollah's leader, Hashim Safieddine. Israel has also attacked the main road on the border between Lebanon and Syria. Rulul Amin from the refugee agency UNHCR described the impact of that airstrike.
This is the major entry point to Syria that most Lebanese and Syrians who had fled the bombings have been using. So we have seen over the past 10 days thousands and thousands of Lebanese and Syrians crossing this point. Today, the airstrike, which has hit in a no man's land between Syria and Lebanon, between the two border posts, has actually halted all kind of traffic. But people were so desperate to flee the bombings that we saw so many families with their children, with their belongings, walking on foot around the damage, trying to get to Syria, hoping for a safe spot and protection for their children. Many of them arrived very exhausted, traumatized, and they had walked and or drove for hours until they were able to reach the border.
That was Rulul Amin from the UNHCR, where the Israeli army said it had targeted a site at the border crossing where weapons were transferred to Hezbollah, and also an underground tunnel between Lebanon and Syria, the location of which wasn't specified. Israeli forces have told residents of over 20 towns in southern Lebanon to leave for their safety today, prompting more people to flee. Samar El-Yassir is country director for the refugee charity Anira in Lebanon.
We are in a big humanitarian crisis. 30% of Lebanon's population is now displaced. Their needs are immense. They need everything. The people had to flee their homes with only the clothes they have on them. They didn't take anything with them. They had to flee because of the evacuation notices, which, you know, prompts them to quickly leave their homes. So they need everything from medicine to food to hygiene to bedding items to clothing. So everything, they need everything.
That was Samar al-Yasir. Well, Israel has given a figure of 250 Hezbollah fighters and 9 of its own soldiers since it crossed the border into Lebanon this week. Let's hear now from the BBC's Lina Sinjab in Beirut. What's been happening today?
Well, it's a very stressing time here in Beirut or in Lebanon in general, but certainly more so in Beirut and in the south. You know, as I'm speaking to you, the sound of drones is continuous all day, hovering over the skies of Beirut. And everyone knows that these drones are looking for, you know, targets, and they don't know when they will attack or where they will attack. You know, the Israelis say they are targeting Hezbollah. They are, you know, pushing Hezbollah from the border to secure the border and get 60,000 Israelis back to their homes. But what we're seeing is actually an expanded campaign that is, you know, targeting not only the leadership of Hezbollah, but maybe almost every member of Hezbollah. And with this campaign, many civilians are targeted. You know, Dahi has been destroyed. We woke up yesterday on an attack as well in central Beirut. The attack, this one overnight today, was so close to the airport that people are so much worried that the airport will be out of function. And also the airstrike that, you know, hit the road to Damascus, that border crossing. Almost all the scenarios are a reminder for people of the 30 days war in 2006 that crippled the country and, you know, stopped the airport from functioning. And that's the scenario that no one wants to live again.
Israel said that one of the targets of the airstrikes was the man expected to take over as Hezbollah's leader, Hashem Safiyadeen. Any word on his fate?
So far, there hasn't been any confirmation, even from the Israelis, that he's been, you know, assassinated. The Hezbollah has not made any announcement. But, you know, thinking out about all the scenarios that have been, you know, with the targets against Hezbollah in Dahi itself, you know, one would think that Hezbollah would not be running other meetings with leadership, and they will have to have a different scenario of meeting or moving around so that they have these targets. But of course, the Israelis know what they're doing. We've seen that over the past 2 weeks. They had a list of names, and they've got them one after the other. So everything is possible.
I mean, it used to be said that it was not safe in southern Lebanon. It was not safe in southern Beirut. But as you've already touched upon, more and more of Lebanon is becoming a war zone.
It is, and you can't imagine the feeling, you know, here in the city. It's becoming a deadly city, you know, by the minute. I mean, everyone has a family member or a friend who's leaving. Streets are, you know, becoming darker at night. And don't forget that this is a country that is already living a financial crisis. You know, there are displaced people almost in every street, in every building around you. And, you know, it's just a very sad moment for Lebanon and for the Lebanese. And the problem is that they don't see an end in sight, that they don't feel that the international community is standing for its values in protecting civilians and halting any aggression by one country on the other. They feel that the world has given the Israelis a green light to do whatever they want to do and finish the job that they say they want to do. But the problem is the belief here among the Lebanese is that Israel's target is beyond destroying Hezbollah, and they might have like other agenda in mind that could whole Lebanon could pay the price for.
That was the BBC's Lina Sinjab in Beirut. Well, more than 1,200 people have been killed since Israel began its assault on Lebanon, and more than 1 million have been forced to flee their homes. Those figures from the Lebanese government. Speaking at a news conference in New York, spokesperson for the UN Secretary General, Stefan Dujarric, urged all sides to avoid civilian casualties.
Beirut residential areas, as you know, were once again subjected to intense overnight Israeli airstrikes, apparently injuring rescue workers. Also, strikes continued unabated in other parts of Lebanon. The toll on civilians from this campaign is totally unacceptable. All parties must do whatever they can at all times to protect civilians and civilian infrastructure and ensure that civilians are never put in harm's way.
And the 900 shelters in Beirut that the government has allocated for the displaced are now full, says the United Nations, while Israel's continuing bombardment has forced four hospitals to close in southern Lebanon, according to the government, while one in Beirut has scaled back services after being damaged in an Israeli airstrike. Mouenes Kalakesh is the director of South Lebanon's Madayoun government hospital.
Our hospital was targeted today by Israeli strikes. The main entrance was bombed and paramedics who were at the entrance were hit. Seven paramedics were killed and five people were injured.
So do you feel it is too dangerous to continue offering treatment to patients?
It is dangerous. It's also not the first time the area around the hospital has been targeted. But today the hospital was directly targeted. There was a high number of injuries. There was a sense of terror and fear among the healthcare staff. This is in addition to the suffering we've endured over the last year. We're on the front line on the border with occupied Palestine.
So are you closing down?
We were obliged to shut down the hospital because of the Israeli attacks. Also, we're lacking some healthcare staff, and there is fear among the staff. So we were forced to leave the hospital. Health workers moved to Nabatea. At some stage, we'll return and open the hospital.
Have you been receiving many people who've been injured by the Israeli bombardment?
For nearly a year, we've been receiving injured and martyrs. We've received more than 430 injured, also more than 50 martyrs, all because of the Israeli bombing.
Why do you think the Israelis have been targeting your hospital? Do you have any Hezbollah positions nearby?
As far as I know, nothing around the hospital belongs to Hezbollah or anyone else. They are just healthcare facilities. We just provide healthcare to the people who come to us. Now, why were we targeted? This is what the Israelis do.
But I wondered whether your hospital was clearly marked as a hospital.
Of course, this hospital is well known. It's been here since 1950, and everyone in the area knows it. It offers health care, nothing more, nothing less.
That was Mouenes Kalakesh, the director of South Lebanon's Madayoun government hospital. And we have contacted the Israeli army and asked them to respond to the allegations that they've targeted hospitals, but they haven't yet responded. And a reminder that you can listen to NewsHour whenever you like. We've got two editions a day. You can find the latest online at bbcworldservice.com. Better still, sign up for our free download. Just search for BBC NewsHour podcast. Coming up is Melania Trump causing political ructions among Republican women. She says in a new book that women should be free to decide on whether or not to have an abortion.
I'm glad that the First Lady feels like that she has the freedom to stand up and speak what's on her heart. Even though many of us in the Republican Party disagree with her opinion, it doesn't mean that we don't disagree with her right to come out and speak for what she believes in.
And the latest headlines from the BBC newsroom. Lebanon says four hospitals in the south are out of action as Israel continues its offensive against Hezbollah. The UN says all 900 government shelters for the displaced are now full. And the United States says it's carried out a series of airstrikes on some of Yemen's main cities in which the Houthi movement holds sway. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. Ever since last year's October the 7th attacks by Hamas on Israel, deemed a terrorist group by many Western governments, Israel has mounted an assault on what it says are the perpetrators of the violence in Gaza. Violence in the occupied West Bank has also surged, with more than 700 Palestinians killed, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry, in clashes with Israeli forces and Jewish settlers. And the ministry is now saying that at least 18 Palestinians have been killed in an Israeli drone attack on a cafe in the Tul Karem refugee camp in the West Bank. Israel says it killed the local head of Hamas and other important militants. I spoke to Mohammed Daragmi, the Israeli bureau chief of Al Sharq News, a Dubai-based news website.
An Israeli warplane, we don't know if it was a warplane or a drone, attacked a coffee shop late Thursday in Tul Karem refugee camp, killing 18 people and injuring others. The Israelis said that they were targeting a Hamas member in that coffee shop, and that's why they attacked the entire coffee shop.
This isn't the first time, though, is it, that Israel has targeted members of Hamas in the occupied West Bank?
Yes, previously they targeted Hamas or Islamic Jihad members individually or among small group, like in a car. This time, they targeted the entire environment where the guy was staying.
This sounds very like the kind of tactics that Israel is employing at the moment in Lebanon and has previously done in Gaza.
That's right. That way was familiar widely in Gaza Strip and currently in Lebanon, where the Israelis are fighting small armies. In Gaza, there is a small army with rockets, with grenades, with roadside bombs. In Lebanon, the same. But in West Bank, there are no such weapon, no such clashes. There are some gunmen who hold individual guns, and the Israelis never used that kind of tactic that they bomb the entire house or social environment where the gunman is staying. So, yes, this is new in West Bank in terms of its scale.
Are there concerns in the occupied West Bank that the territory could become another Gaza, could become another Lebanon?
People are deeply concerned that the Israelis are going in a new phase of attacks in West Bank by targeting the local environment, social environment of the ones that are identified by Israel as a fugitive or wanted. People now fear that they are using the same tactic, and people are terrified, actually.
I mean, is there a considerable Hamas presence in the occupied West Bank?
Yes, Hamas is there, but the number of Hamas militants and Islamic Jihad militants are limited to, let me say, dozens in Jenin refugee camp, in Tul Karem, in Nur Shams, in Al Far'a, in Tubas, five or six communities in North and West Bank.
I was just wondering whether civilians in the occupied West Bank resented the presence of Hamas and Islamic Jihad.
Many people, including myself, are arguing, what's the point of having gunmen in the occupied West Bank when the Israeli security are all over the place and targeting by a very sophisticated means, including the artificial intelligence? So many are criticizing Hamas for recruiting gunmen in this area. But those people mostly volunteer to carry guns and maybe carry out attacks simply because they are emotional. They are seeing the atrocities of the war in Gaza. They want to react without deep thinking of the consequences. But most of the West Bankers, I think, are not encouraging this phenomenon, and that's why it is limited mostly to these impoverished areas in North and West Bank, particularly refugee camps.
Mohammed Daragmi, the Israeli bureau chief of the Al Shark News, a Dubai-based news website, and Hamas's armed wing has just confirmed the death of one of its commanders, Zahi Yasser Ufi, in that Israeli strike on the West Bank refugee camp of Tul Karem, along with seven other fighters. In a rare public sermon at Friday's prayers today, Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has said that Iran and its regional leaders will not back down in their confrontation with Israel. But who are those regional allies? Where does Saudi Arabia, for instance, stand in this deepening conflict in Lebanon and between Israel and Iran? It's said by many that one of the reasons behind Hamas's attacks on Israel last year was to sabotage an impending rapprochement between Israel and Saudi Arabia. But Saudi Arabia and Iran have also been seeking to improve relations. Iran's President Masoud Pezeshkian had warm words for Saudi Arabia this week, while the Saudi foreign minister at the same meeting said, and I quote, "We aim to permanently close the chapter on our differences." Ali Shahabi is an author and commentator on the politics and economics of Saudi Arabia. I asked him if he thought Saudi Arabia was torn.
Torn is a bit of an emotional word, really. I think Saudi Arabia would like to have good relations with Iran, but Iranian behavior has not met Iran's positive diplomatic talk, particularly in the way that Iran continues to support the Houthi militants in Yemen. So Saudi Arabia continues to make an effort diplomatically and to genuinely state that they would like to have good relations with Iran, but they approach this with a certain amount of skepticism, and it will depend on Iranian behavior. Now, at the same time, Saudi Arabia will also not be a party to any attack by Israel or America on Iran. So, for example, Saudi airspace will not be open to Israel or America to attack Iran.
So it's Iran's continuing support for the Houthi rebels in Yemen that is testing Saudi Arabia's patience.
That has tested it for a while. And, you know, Hezbollah was part of that because Hezbollah was the subcontractor of the Iranian government in sort of for Arab affairs. And Hezbollah had trainers in Yemen who were there to help the Houthis in their attacks on Saudi Arabia. So it was Iran and Hezbollah, really, that were the backbone of the Houthi movement.
Now, you say Saudi Arabia is opposed to any attack on Iran by Israel, in which, of course, it would be aided probably by the United States. President Biden said a few hours ago that his hope was that Israel wouldn't target Iran's oil facilities. Presumably, Saudi Arabia would go along with that.
Yes, in the sense that it doesn't want Iran's oil facilities to be targeted, absolutely, because it doesn't want to establish the precedent. The Iranians have threatened unofficially that they might hit back at oil facilities of the Gulf states, the GCC states who are allied with America. So although that is unlikely, it still is a risk. So Saudi Arabia would certainly like a de-escalation by everybody involved. It's been pressuring the Americans to pressure the Israelis to de-escalate. And it's been telling the Iranians also to de-escalate because, the Saudi argument is that you're playing into the hands of the Netanyahu government.
And I was speaking there to Ali Shahabi, Saudi commentator.
Was ist noch besser als ein guter Plan? Die Möglichkeit, ihn zu ändern. Mit integrierter KI bietet Workday kontinuierliche Innovationen, die Ihnen helfen, agil zu bleiben, egal was passiert. Workday, the finance and HR system for a changing world.
The Inquiry goes beyond the headlines, exploring the trends, forces and ideas shaping the world.
Politics.
Civil society.
Products and services.
AI.
Each week we ask one big question.
Can Germany's far right win the country?
And go in search of answers with the help of four expert witnesses.
Is Turkey getting more dangerous for women?
The Inquiry from the BBC World Service. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. 3 months ago, Donald Trump survived an assassination attempt at a rally in Butler, Pennsylvania, but two people in the crowd sustained life-altering injuries, and one man, a 50-year-old volunteer firefighter named Corey Compitore, died while shielding his wife and daughters. Corey's widow, Helen, spoke exclusively to the BBC's Gary O'Donoghue about her husband and her tremendous loss.
Corey was very quiet. He was always very straight-faced and serious, but he was so sweet and kind. He did anything for his community. He loved his kids. His kids were everything to him. Wonderful husband.
How did you guys meet?
In school.
Really?
Yeah, we went to school together since kindergarten. So I've known Corey my whole life, pretty much. And what was weird was the day before he was killed, my youngest daughter pulled out his senior photo that he had given to me, and on the back, he had written, thanked me for being his best friend. And he actually teared up and looked at me and said, thank you for being my best friend. So it was just kind of weird that we had that moment, you know, the day before.
And what was his, what were his passions? What did he care about?
He was very passionate about his people under his roof. Everything was about his family under his roof. He was very passionate about God and, you know, things like that. And he loved Trump.
How do you feel about the day itself now? It's so raw and so recent. Is it something you can think about, or do you find it hard to?
I see it every time I close my eyes. And probably will for a long time.
So now I ask that we observe a moment of silence in honor of our friend Corey.
All day, Corey kept saying, guys, I have to sit on the end over here because he's going to call me on stage and I have to be able to get down. He's going to say, Corey, I need you, bud. It's time for you to come up here. And it was like the joke all day. So, you know, obviously then he was killed. And then I just cried because, you know, I said he got his moment on stage with Trump. So, you know, it was kind of like a nice moment, but it was a sad moment at the same time. But
must have made you proud.
It did.
Do you feel angry about losing him?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm angry because there were a lot of mistakes made that day. And it didn't have to happen.
That was Helen, the widow of Corey Compitore, speaking to the BBC's Gary O'Donoghue. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Julian Marshall. And now for what is a potential trade war between the European Union and China. The European Commission has received enough support from EU member states to implement tariffs on electric vehicles made in China. Tariffs are set to rise from 10% to up to 45% over the next 5 years. But not all EU countries are happy, and there are worries about how China will react. Hildegard Müller, who heads the main lobby group of German car makers, said the development was bad news for car buyers.
Today's decision may be the beginning of a further escalation in the trade disputes with China. We need to hold critical discussions here, but we do not consider the instrument of introducing tariffs to be appropriate. And the news is also difficult for consumers, because the tariffs will make electric cars more expensive.
And I've been speaking to Janke Oertel from the European Council on Foreign Relations, which has been advising the European Union. So what lies behind this decision to impose tariffs?
The discussion has been going on for quite some time. The investigation has been launched last year, and it is sort of a long-going and ongoing process of tackling overcapacities emanating from China.
And are these imported Chinese electric vehicles that much cheaper than those produced within the European Union?
Yes, I mean, of course, the prices vary, but there are differences in price that are up to 50% cheaper. This is why the tariff range that we're seeing that is supposed to be imposed now is also varying and is quite nuanced.
I suppose one alternative could be for EU countries to make their electric vehicles that much cheaper.
Well, the problem that we're seeing in the electric vehicle sector is not only that the European vehicles are not necessarily at the same quality level, that they're not at the same price point, but also that they're increasingly produced actually in China. And that is a problem that the Commission is trying to tackle as well. So the fact that you don't want to actually encourage the fact that European companies move their production, their R&D centers for their electric vehicle lines to China because the ecosystem there is so beneficial for electric vehicle production, but actually want to incentivize them to continue to produce vehicles also in Europe, that is, I think, part of the conversation that we're having here. It holds true for Volkswagen, holds true for Cupra, the Seat spin-off, for example.
Is there unanimity among EU member states about this move? And Germany not too happy?
There has been broad support for this move among member states, but Germany has been particularly vocal against imposing any tariffs because it is actually exporting vehicles to China. It is worried about its own prospects within the Chinese market. And it is obviously also worried about Volkswagen producing in China, then exporting it to the European market. So on multiple levels, Germany and Spain will be actually hit by these tariffs themselves. And therefore, there is huge concern, which actually led to the fact that Olaf Scholz, the German chancellor, used his veto power, which is very rarely used in German coalition governments, last night to impose his own view of voting no in the decisions today.
I mean, could it be that China is able to absorb these new tariffs?
And to a large extent,
they don't have the intended effect?
To an extent, Chinese companies will be able to absorb tariffs. This is part of the problem, that Chinese companies are not operating under normal market conditions, that even kind of 20%, 15%, 30% can be absorbed because they will then cut into margins. And some of these vehicles are sold at a much lower price in China in the first place. But this does impose a price on European consumers buying Chinese vehicles. It just makes that vehicle more expensive for now. And if the Chinese company decides to kind of basically swallow this price increase entirely, it imposes a price on the Chinese company. It makes it less attractive to sell to Europe, or it makes it more attractive to set up production within Europe, which is what some member states would like to see happening as well.
That was Janke Oertel from the European Council on Foreign Relations. South America has exceeded its record for wildfires this year, with hundreds of thousands being recorded across the continent. The Amazon rainforest in Brazil has experienced its worst fires in two decades. More than 62,000 square kilometres of the Brazilian Amazon have burned this year alone, an area bigger than some small countries like Sri Lanka or Costa Rica. The majority are started criminally, but they've been made worse by Brazil's most severe drought on record. Our South America correspondent, Ione Wells, has been to the Brazilian Amazon to investigate how it's affected people there and indeed the environment.
It was burning more than 15 days.
Imagine that it is your home, the place you live, that's on fire. That's the very real situation for the indigenous community of Caiquito.
If these fires continue, we'll no longer have life.
Raimundinha Rodrigues da Souza is the chief of the local indigenous fire brigade team that's been trying to put out fires here.
Because today it is killing the plants. In a while, it will be us, because we inhale so much. It is a very aggressive fire that really kills everything that comes its way. When we arrived at the scene and monitored the area to see where it started, we know whether it was arson, because we find a bottle, often a bottle of gasoline, a match tip.
As we speak, she spots smoke emerging from some of the trees behind us, a sign another criminal fire has been started. We're with the fire brigade team now, and they found a fire It's a small one, but it's certainly significant. And some of the flames have risen up the trees, spread across the ground. There are whole trees on the floor blackened to charcoal, and the ground underfoot is basically reduced to white powder. They're trying now to put out the fire before it spreads any further. These fires are a disaster, but not a natural one. In most cases, the match was lit by a human. Loggers, miners, farmers, clearing land. In many cases, illegally. You can see big fields, piles of logs everywhere on the side of the road here. Many argue it's a waste to leave so much land protected rather than productive. Doris Marluise Baruffi is a farmer. He's legally owned land here for many years, but he explained why there's been such a boom in farming in the Amazon.
I think it is due to the growth of the population that has increased planting up here. It rained well here. I believe if you're working within the law, there's no problem here. It is a place that provides food. It is a state that can produce a lot. So I think there is still a lot of area to be cultivated here in Amazonas.
These fires might be started by humans, but they're made worse by a record drought in Brazil that is turning the forest into a tinderbox. Every day, people like João Mendoza have to collect water from parts of the river where there is still some and bring it to their community where there isn't.
It's the worst drought I've ever seen in my entire life.
João and others are carrying huge, heavy bottles of water on their backs, walking far in the baking sun, barefoot, across what would have been the riverbed of the Madeira River, a tributary of the Amazon. Now, though, the ground is very, very dry, covered in huge cracks. There's absolutely no water to be seen here. The impact on local communities here is really obvious, but this matters more widely for the whole world too. The world relies on the Amazon to absorb a lot of its carbon. Just looking at the sky here, covered in smoke, it's now emitting record amounts itself.
That report by our South America correspondent, Ione Wells. The former US First Lady Melania Trump makes few public statements, even fewer on political matters, so her intervention on reproductive rights is attracting plenty of attention. In his election campaign, her husband Donald, the Republican nominee for president, has been taking credit for appointing Supreme Court judges who removed universal access to abortion while avoiding the anger that followed their ruling. Melania Trump has come out equivocally on the side of abortion rights, both in her new memoir, which is published next week, and in a video statement posted on X, timed for its release.
Individual freedom is a fundamental principle that I safeguard. Without a doubt, there is no room for compromise when it comes to this essential right that all women possess from birth. Individual freedom. What does my body, my choice really mean?
That was Melania Trump. And Pam Pollard is the former chair of Oklahoma Republican Party. NewsHour's James Kumarasamy asked what she made of Melania Trump's intervention.
I'm glad that the First Lady feels like that she has the freedom to stand up and speak what's on her heart. Even though many of us in the Republican Party disagree with her opinion, it doesn't mean that we don't disagree with her right to come out and speak for what she believes in.
Will it influence the election, do you think? I mean, she is an influential figure in the party, isn't she? And she's speaking, I guess, to those who perhaps don't agree with you. And that appears to be the majority of the American public who still, by I think 2/3 to 1/3, favour abortion rights in some cases.
I don't think it's going to necessarily influence the election as far as this being a great revelation that could cause more people, you know, to vote for President Trump. That would put him over the top. In all of the polls that are done, abortion is issue number 9 or 10 down. the number one issue that women, this is a poll of women, middle-aged women, the number one issue is the economy. The number two is border and security for their families. So that's what women really care about. I think that it's interesting to them to hear that Melania agrees with them. But as far as it being a deciding issue, they're more concerned about the economy and the border.
But there
right
are fine margins potentially in this election, are there not? And this could reassure some women who would want to vote Republican but are concerned about abortion rights.
I think that her statement may bring a few more people in to vote for her husband, but I think that there's also a danger of this offending people who believe in the fundamental right of the baby that is inside the womb.
Yes,
that's
I was going to ask you. You think this could have the opposite effect? Someone very close to Donald Trump speaking in this way could turn off some who thought he was in favor of the same issues as you.
The bottom line is I agree with the Supreme Court. This issue is not addressed in our Constitution, or in our Constitution directly says it. Issues not defined in this are sent back to the states. So when the Supreme Court decided that, they did not agree to overturn Roe v. Wade. They agreed with the Dobbs decision, and the Dobbs said this is a state issue. So each state is going to have the ability and the freedom to vote on it. And they know that the power is with the state, not with the president.
That was Pam Pollard, the former chair of Oklahoma, Republican Party, speaking to my colleague James Kumarasamy. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall, and this is NewsHour. Following the assassination of the Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah a week ago, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu described his death as an historic turning point. But a turn in what direction? The ongoing attacks on senior Hezbollah leaders and its military infrastructure have undoubtedly weakened the armed group, which is an Iranian proxy and which Tehran sees as a buffer to Israeli power in the region. Reacting to this week's Iranian attack on Israel, the former right-wing Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett set out this vision for the future of the region on X, formerly known as Twitter. It's read by one of our team.
Israel has now its greatest opportunity in 50 years to change the face of the Middle East. The leadership in Iran, which used to be good at chess, made a terrible mistake this evening. We must act now to destroy Iran's nuclear program, its central energy facilities, and to cripple this terrorist regime. To strike the head of the octopus of terror that in cowardice sent its tentacles, Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis, etc., to murder us, while the Ayatollahs sat safely in their palaces in Tehran. The octopus's tentacles are temporarily paralyzed. Now comes the head. We must remove this terrible threat to our children's future. We can grant the Iranian people an opportunity to rise up and shake off the regime that terrorizes its women and daughters. We have the justification. We have the tools. Now that Hezbollah and Hamas are paralyzed, Iran stands exposed.
The former right-wing Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, or rather his words, whereas this was what the Jordanian foreign minister Ayam Safadi had to say speaking 4 days ago at the UN General Assembly.
We're here, members of a Muslim Arab committee mandated by 57 Arab and Muslim countries, and I can tell you here very unequivocally, all of us are willing to right now guarantee the security of Israel in the context of Israel ending the occupation and allowing for the emergence of a Palestinian state. He is creating that danger because he simply does not want the two-state solution. And if he does not want the two-state solution, can you ask the Israeli officials, what is their end game?
Well, to discuss those two statements, we brought together Trita Parsi, who's executive president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft in Washington, and Professor Yossi Meckelberg, associate fellow of the Middle East and North Africa program at the Chatham House think tank here in London. Firstly, what did the professor make of Naftali Bennett's statement?
It's not new. Actually, when he was prime minister, he spoke about this kind of metaphor of the octopus head and the tentacles, and the idea that now that one of the most important proxies of Iran suffered quite severe blows from Israel, it's time to go straight and deal with Iranian nuclear. And he even mentions the oil and gas installations. He thinks that you can reshape like this the Middle East, and probably it's another one of these grand ideas of regime change in another country, which we've seen time and again.
Is it the view of the current Israeli government under Benjamin Netanyahu?
I don't think it's the view of Netanyahu himself. I mean, in principle, he wouldn't mind it to happen, but I don't think it's something that he would like to operationalize. I think there are elements within the Israeli government, definitely from among the far right, that will support something along these lines. But this is, I think it needs to be emphasized. This is a very dangerous strategy to take. It's basically opening an all-out war in the region when the two major current military powers squaring to one another directly.
Tudor Parsi, can I bring you in? And the Jordanian foreign minister there, Ayman Safadi, speaking about the willingness of Arab states to make peace with Israel under certain conditions. Was he speaking for Jordan or for the Arab world in its entirety?
Well, he was certainly speaking for quite a few of the Arab states, and essentially what he's laying out there is not controversial at all, or even far-fetched. It's the Beirut Declaration of 2002, the Arab Peace Plan, which essentially says that they will all recognize Israel, come to peace with Israel, if Israel also allows for the emergence of a Palestinian state. Nominally, this is also what the United States says that it supports, although, of course, in practice, it does not. It vetoes resolutions that recognize Palestine. And of course, inside of the Israeli political establishment, up until recently, many of the parties still adhere to the two-state solution. Clearly, at this point, many of them don't. And I would say that Netanyahu never has. But it's not until recently that he's been more ready to very openly reject it in the manner that he has recently. I completely agree with the Israeli professor that this is yet another one of these delusions of thinking that one can transform the Middle East through force. And this is coming after clearly a major, major setback for Hezbollah through Israel's operations. But what so oftentimes happens when you strike a successful military success is that you end up with hubris and you think that you can go all the way now. And even the United States cannot do that. It tried to change the face of the Middle East by occupying Afghanistan for 20 years, and it turned out to be an absolute disaster. And the Taliban are now back in power there. So this is a very dangerous moment. And I think the one area I would perhaps disagree with the professor slightly is that I do think that Netanyahu wants it, but Netanyahu is not looking for Israel to do it. Netanyahu is looking for Israel to start this war and have the United States finish it.
Professor, will he get his way?
Well, first of all, I agree. In principle, yes, when I meant Netanyahu, he doesn't think that Israel can do it on its own. But he would be more than satisfied if he managed to drag the United States into doing so. And that's why this is such a perilous moment in the Middle East. We are waiting right now. There is some expectation of Israel to retaliate to the Iran's attack 2-3 days ago. And the question for how long this tit for tat will be really being to manage it in a way that it won't develop into or evolve into a full-scale war.
Could I just have a final word from Tudor Parsi, and very, very briefly, do you ever see the kind of sentiments that the Jordanian foreign minister was expressing there ever happening, for instance, in the lifetime of this government or future Israeli governments? Very, very briefly.
It's odd because on the one hand, it looks very far-fetched. On the other hand, it is still the most likely outcome, I would say, because all of the other ideas, such as transforming the Middle East through force and everything else, is actually far more far-fetched and far more likely to fail.
Tudor Parsi, Executive President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. We also heard from Professor Yossi Meckelberg of the Chatham House think tank here in London. That's it from this news hour. From me, Julian Marshall, and the rest of the team in London, goodbye.
1 year on from the Hamas attack on Israel, Global News podcast listeners have been sending in their questions for BBC correspondents about everything that's happened since, about the escalating conflict in the wider Middle East, and where we might go from here to try to bring an end to the bloodshed. Find the Global News podcast special edition on the Middle East in the regular Global News podcast feed, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.